Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Ahead on the show, the sounds of gospel fill our studio when Naomi Shelton and the Gospel Queens join us to play live. And there's an unusual documentary coming out next month about the Australian musician Nick Cave. The filmmakers will tell us how they got inside the mind of a songwriter known for dark lyrics and an even darker sense of humor. Now, speaking of humor, last week, the New Yorker magazine's website published a piece called Sonny Rollins in His Own Words. In this piece, the legendary 83-year-old saxophonist, one of the greatest living figures in jazz, apparently vents about how much he hates jazz. Here's a quote. "Jazz might be the stupidest thing anyone ever came up with. The band starts a song, but then everything falls apart, and the musicians just play whatever they want as long as they can stand it. People take turns noodling around, and once they run out of ideas and have to stop, the audience claps. I'm getting angry just thinking about it." Now, you might be thinking, Sonny Rollins wrote that? Well, of course he didn't. The essay appeared in the magazine's online humor column, The Daily Shout, and it was written by Django Gold, who also contributes to the satirical newspaper The Onion. But many jazz fans were not amused by the piece, which they say made a joke about jazz at the expense of a beloved figure. Others thought that the piece was funny and that the fans' reaction revealed that jazz takes itself too seriously. Well, you know what that means, folks.
Soundcheck Smackdown!
Yes, it is time for another Soundcheck Smackdown, and two guests join me to square off on the New Yorker's Sonny Rollins satire. Howard Mandel is a longtime jazz writer who skewered the New Yorker in a piece on the website Arts Journal, and Ashley Hamer is a jazz saxophonist who loved the piece and tweeted, "This weekend, the New Yorker found out that jazz fans don't have a sense of humor." Both of them join us from the studio of WBEZ in Chicago. Howard, Ashley, to both of you, welcome to Soundcheck.
Thank you, John.
Thank you very much.
Howard, what was your first reaction when you initially read that piece?
Oh, gosh, this is dumb. That was what I thought. I thought, this is so stupid. And, you know, it's going to send a very confused message to the world. It's just like, oh, gosh. And it's in the New Yorker? Gee, Louise, I mean...
But it was in the New Yorker's Daily Shout page, which is their, that's their humor column.
Well, actually, when it was on Facebook projected that way, it did not say Daily Shout. It does not say humor column. It has a very serious inset of Sonny Rollins, and it says Sonny Rollins in His Own Words. Now, I mean, I'm a sophisticated New Yorker reader. I've read New Yorker all my life, and I know what Shouts and Murmurs is. I don't usually read it online, so I didn't realize it was a Daily Shouts column. But I obviously knew it was not Sonny Rollins saying this. Many people thought it was Sonny Rollins saying this. And the problem is, you know, when something like that goes out on the internet now, it goes all around the world, and people who do not understand all of the nuanced signage on the site or don't see it in that form because it's forwarded to them as an excerpt or something like that, they have no idea.
Mm. Ashley, what was your first reaction to the piece?
Well, I'll say it definitely took me a second, probably a couple paragraphs in. I was like, what is this? And as I figured out what was going on, I started laughing more and more and more because it's just so ridiculous. Like, jazz musicians are known to be some of the hardest workers. They, you know, obviously this is not true, but it's such an absurd and kind of hilarious idea that like, what if all of these guys just hated jazz and the only reason they had these long and storied careers was that they just couldn't quit? I thought that was really funny, and I laughed out loud at it.
Well, you know, the first paragraph, I mean, when I came to this, it was, I found it on the New Yorker website. It was on the Daily Shout page. It was clearly part of their humor column. But Howard, if you found it on Facebook without any sort of knowledge of where it came from, I could see how the first paragraph could sort of raise an eyebrow. The writer goes, I started playing the saxophone when I was 13 years old. There were other kids on my block who had taken it up, and I thought it might be fun. I later learned that these guys' parents had forced them into it. Okay, you know, that sounds completely plausible to me. But then the next line, the saxophone sounds horrible, like a scared pig. I mean, I never learned the names of most of the other instruments, but they all sound awful too. I mean, at that point, you had to know that this was not Sonny Rollins.
Well, I knew that it was not Sonny Rollins. I've interviewed Sonny Rollins. I've written pieces on Sonny Rollins. I've met Sonny Rollins backstage. But what really got me was the last lines, I've wasted my life. To me, that's not words that you put into an 83-year-old man's parody. It's not particularly funny. I mean, I didn't laugh. I didn't think that the humor was humorous. Now, there's certainly room for people to have a different sense of humor, and, you know, if they laughed at it and thought it was hilarious. But, okay, if we study satire, what is the joke here? Who is being attacked? What pomposities are being punctured? And I think it's disingenuous to say, well, we were trying to goof on the seriousness of jazz fans.
Ashley, do you have an answer to the question that Howard just posed? What pomposity is being punctured here?
I don't think anyone was being attacked. I don't think anything was being punctured. I think it was... it was just a bit of absurdity that puts you in a fun new universe. I mean, I think another thing that a lot of critics of it are saying is it kind of sounds like it's just some guy who doesn't like jazz who's making fun of it. But, I mean, it was very clear from the things that he included that he knows jazz. He's clearly a jazz fan. Django Gold tweeted to Sonny Rollins that, like, you're the king. Like, thank you for having a sense of humor about this. And it's, you know, I everyone's talking about how it's making fun of jazz fans and jazz seriousness, but I don't think it's actually making fun of anything.
Well, if it's not making fun of anything, I don't know what the point is.
Howard, if it were funny, in your view, would that be okay? Would that make the whole piece okay, despite, you know, whatever other reservations you have about it?
Well, if it was funny, then it would be a different piece, so it's kind of hard to imagine. On my blog posting, I linked to a story by Donald Bartlemy, the King of Jazz, is the name of the story, mm-hmm. that was published in The New Yorker. It's a funny piece, and there are many other funny pieces about jazz. The Spinal Tap interview about jazz is hilarious. Sonny Rollins is a funny guy. Fats Waller was funny. Duke Ellington made jokes, you know.
Well, this
wasn't funny. That's the greatest sin. It's not funny. You know, the piece about Miles Davis, it's pathetic. And, I mean, you can kind of believe that Miles Davis would be having an existential crisis backstage and say, okay, let's go out and do this.
This is towards the end of the article called Sonny Rollins in His Own Words. Once I played the Montreux Jazz Festival in Switzerland with Miles Davis, I walked in on him smoking cigarettes and staring at his horn for what must have been 15 minutes like it was a poisonous snake and he wasn't sure if it was dead. Finally, Miles stood up, turned to his band and said, all right, let's get through this and we'll go to the airport. He looked like he was about to cry. I thought that was actually pretty funny.
I think most people have trouble imagining that Miles Davis ever cried a tear in his
life.
Yeah,
really.
I think that's
the
point.
Now, Ashley, you tweeted this. You quoted from Howard's article, not that jazz is sacrosanct, but equals every jazz fan's intro to their objection to that Sonny Rollins piece. Does this kind of... you know, play into the stereotype that is being skewered in this work of satire?
I think it does. And I've talked to some of my friends who aren't jazz fans, and that's something that they've come up with independently, saying, like, this is just showing what the stereotypes are of jazz fans, that they just can't take a joke, that they're very serious about this stuff. I think one of the problems that people had with the article is that, and Sonny Rollins said this himself, that, you know, jazz is kind of the underdog, that we're not doing so well as far as popularity is concerned right now. And this is not helping. I feel like if you're going to get, you know, young blood into, like, enjoying live jazz, you can't you can't make it stuffy like a fine wine or something like that. You have to, you know, you got to loosen up.
Well, now we asked both of you. Again, we're speaking with Howard Mandel, the jazz writer, long based in New York but recently relocated to his old hometown there in Chicago, and Ashley Hamer, the jazz sax player based in Chicago. We're talking about this New Yorker piece that was part of their Daily Shout humor column called Sonny Rollins in His Own Words. Now, Howard, you said that not only does Sonny Rollins have a sense of humor, you've picked a piece of music for us that displays that. Tell us about I'm an Old Cowhand.
Well, Sonny made a record in, I guess, the late 50s called Way Out West, in which on the cover he's wearing a cowboy hat and toy six guns. And one of the pieces he plays is I'm an Old Cowhand, which is, you know, a really good, humored, funny song.
Mm-hmm.
And he's laughing. But, you know, Sonny is such a wonderful, compassionate, and multidimensional musician that he can express humor and love for something at the same time in his sound. And that's what one of the things we love about him. And this is not the only, you know, instance where Sonny pokes fun at a song. I mean, he has a very broad repertoire. No Business Like Show Business, Toot Toot Tootsie Goodbye. He plays songs that we don't usually take very seriously, and he's not taking them exactly seriously, but on the other hand, he is, and he makes it a thing of beauty. That's great.
Let's hear a little bit. Sonny Rollins recording from Way Out West of I'm an Old Cowhand. Sonny Rollins from a 1957 album called Way Out West. That's his recording of the Johnny Mercer song I'm an Old Cowhand. And Howard Mandel picked that because he thinks it shows Sonny's sense of humor. And actually, when we asked Ashley Hamer for a choice, that was your first choice too, wasn't it, Ashley?
It was. I love that one.
All right, so the two of you agree on that at least. Have you guys seen Sonny Rollins' own response, the online video chat about this article in The New Yorker?
Yes.
Yeah, I have.
All right. So what do you make of his disclosure right off the bat that he's a longtime subscriber to Mad Magazine? I thought that was great.
That was great.
He's got a sense of humor.
My reaction to The New Yorker piece was that it was a piece from Mad Magazine. And I saw it, I read it, cursory glance at it, and it was so ridiculous. I had no idea that anybody could conceive of it being true. It was sort of like from Mad Magazine. And as I said, I'm a big Mad Magazine fan. I'm a subscriber for many years.
So that is Sonny Rollins after, you know, sort of being repeatedly questioned about, you know, the effects of the piece and people misunderstanding it. Sonny Rollins began to kind of change the tenor of his response to the New Yorker piece. And again, it was on the New Yorker's website, their Daily Shout column. And he added that he started to feel that the piece ridiculed jazz too much. Listen to this.
They're saying some very, very insulting things about jazz, very derogatory things about jazz. The way it sounds, the way it's played, the musician, everything is really, I can't even repeat it and read the article now. Can't take it.
So Ashley, you know, he also says he's concerned about how young musicians would receive the message in this piece. You know, as a young musician, did something in this piece by Django Gold resonate with you?
I mean, it resonated with me because as a young musician, I'm I'm really into humor. I'm really into just having a good time and making light of a lot of the things that are really central to my life. You know, I'm disappointed that he thought that it was derogatory, but I do think that his first reaction is like precisely how you should react to this article. You know, Mad Magazine, that's a, mm-hmm. a work mm-hmm. of satire, and it was ridiculous, and that was what made it great. The Onion has also featured some jazz humor columns that I really enjoyed. Every time they have something funny about jazz, I'm into it.
So, in general, do you find that jazz takes itself too seriously and needs to be shaken up a bit every now and then?
I don't personally feel that way, but I know that people outside of the jazz community feel that way.
Yeah.
And I want those people inside the jazz community.
I didn't get a sense of love. And whether I did or not, again, I think I'm a very extremely sensitive reader to The New Yorker, to humor columns, and to things about jazz. I thought, this is not good for people who are outside jazz. Like Ashley's saying, you know, she thinks that the non-jazz people always think jazz people are too serious. Well, this is not saying jazz is worth taking seriously and it's lighthearted. It just says, I wasted my life. And Miles Davis doesn't believe in what he's doing. And playing with Bud Powell and Charlie Parker was a drag. And, you know, I can't really even name the other instruments. And this is the stupidest thing that ever happened. It's like again and again and again. It's derogatory. And it's not, there's no twist on it.
Our listener Ben seems to agree with you. He says, I thought it was funny, Ben writes, but it was written from the perspective of someone who has little understanding of jazz, as opposed to Sonny, who mastered it. And Greg writes in and says, it seems to prove that satire is not easy to do well. What about the disclaimer that was added later? The New Yorker eventually, actually pretty quickly, put in a disclaimer that says, you know, this is a work of satire at the bottom of the page. It was then moved to the top of the page. And then finally, the New Yorker's culture desk sent out a tweet saying, dear readers, the Sonny Rollins quote-unquote interview was satire published on our humor blog. Our apologies to anyone who thought it was real. What do you guys make of that? Ashley, Howard mentioned before that this is something that might trail after, you know, Sonny Rollins for the rest of his life because, you know, nothing goes away on the internet. Is that a valid point?
I mean, I think that with this disclaimer, I don't think it will trail him, I think. And also with all of the uproar about it, it's kind of such a famous piece of satire now. Everyone knows that it was satire, that I don't think that anyone will be, you know, using this in, like, a jazz history essays or anything like that.
Howard, is there maybe a silver lining to this dark cloud in that, you know, suddenly there are many, many more people hearing about Sonny Rollins, perhaps for the first time?
I guess so. That would be the silver lining.
I mean, people...
I don't know. Yes, anything that brings attention to Sonny Rollins is great. Sonny Rollins was on The Simpsons. That was great. Mm-hmm. You know, if Sonny Rollins gets a medal from the... president at the White House, as he did last year or the year before, that's great. Being a jazz master is great. Sonny Rollins being in the present is great. Being on television, being in the radio. Sonny Rollins being quoted as saying, I hate my life, I wasted my life. That's not great. And yes, satire is hard. And I think this is a failed attempt at writing humor. Now, if Ashley laughed out loud, you know, I've got to say, we have different sense of humor, and that's very likely and very possible. We're different ages, and we have different backgrounds.
I just wonder if you reframed it, and if you put a different character in his place that didn't have to do with music. Like, I know one person suggested Neil Armstrong. If Neil Armstrong said, "The when I first stepped foot on the moon, that was the worst day of my life. Like, that I just spent my entire life hating science and hating math, and I had to go to the moon." Like, that, I think that's hilarious, too. Like, just putting yourself in this new, strange universe.
The absurdity factor is very much in play in this piece. So, Howard, we asked you for your favorite piece. You picked I'm an Old Cowhand. And, Ashley, once that was off the table because Howard picked it, what was your choice for a favorite Sonny Rollins work?
Well, this one really should have been my first choice, and it was one of those things where I woke up at 6 in the morning and went, "Ah, I should have picked Eternal Triangle." this is one that just shows his just, like, boss mastery of the saxophone. It's there's a cool story behind it.
Did you just use boss as an adjective?
Sunny Side Up, which is Dizzy Gillespie recorded one session with Sonny Stitt, one session with Sonny Rollins, and then he had them both in for this particular track. And the story goes, we don't know if this is true, but the story goes that he called each one of them up individually and said the other one was really getting ready for a cutting session, was totally thought he was going to play better than the other. And you can hear it on the recording. These guys are just giving it everything they have, and it's really amazing.
So they have their own little soundcheck smackdown going on there in the studio.
They do.
That is pretty boss. A word I have not heard used in that.
I don't know why I used that word. I never used that word.
That was
good word.
That's a great... takes me back. All right. Ashley, it has been boss talking to you today.
Howard
Mandel, nice to speak with you again.
Likewise, John.
And what better way to wrap up than with a great tune from Sonny Rollins? Here's Eternal Triangle. Okay, folks, you've heard our guests, jazz saxophonist Ashley Hamer and writer Howard Mandel weighing in. Did you read the Sonny Rollins satire on the New Yorker's website? It's on our website now if you want to check it out. Tell us what you thought of it and the reaction that has followed in the jazz world. Post a comment on our page at soundcheck.org or leave us a voicemail at 866-939-1612. And we just might include you on an upcoming show. Coming up, Naomi Shelton was in her 60s by the time she released her first professional album. Today, she and her group, the Gospel Queens, join us to play songs from their new record, Cold World. And later, inside the upcoming documentary, 20,000 Days on Earth, about the enigmatic musician Nick Cave. This is Soundcheck.
Well, I'm standing by the train station with my ticket in my hand. I know this train bound for the promised land.
This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. The Brooklyn-based singer Naomi Shelton and her group, the Gospel Queens, have returned with a new record last week. It's their first in 5 years. It's called Cold World, but the sound is red hot. They've again teamed up with Daptone Records, the home to groove-heavy singers like Sharon Jones and Charles Bradley, and the result is another stellar blend of sacred and soulful music from Naomi Shelton and the Gospel Queens. They are here in the studio, and they're going to start us off with a live performance of a song called Sinner.
I was born to be delivered, and I know from the depth of my soul. That bought me for my God. I have strayed. Well, am I the only one? I have strayed. Well, am I the only one? Listen, y'all. See, I'm a sinner. Yes, I am. Sinner. Oh, Lord. Look into that other shore. Yes, I am.
Sinner.
Hold on.
Ooh.
Got to find myself a cross.
In my life.
Boy, in my life, I've had trouble. And I had love.
I have tried.
Boy, I tried to grow to the river, y'all. Divide me from my God.
I have gone.
Oh, I've gone down to the river. Yes, I have.
I have found.
Oh,
find myself across. Say I'm a sinner. Trying to buy me for me and my God.
Sinner.
Yes, he is. I don't wanna be a sinner, no, no.
Sinner.
Uh-huh. I wanna be able to walk around with my God one of these days.
Sinner.
Uh-huh.
That is Naomi Shelton and the Gospel Queens live on Soundcheck in a song called Sinner. You'll find that on their new album called Cold World. Naomi Shelton on lead vocals. The Gospel Queens include Edna Johnson, Judy Gibbs, and Bobby Jean Gant. On piano is the group's musical director, Cliff Driver, and on bass, Jeremy Kay, Gabriel Kaplan playing the guitar, and Kevin Congleton behind our drum kit here in the Soundcheck studio. Naomi, welcome back.
Thank you.
So it's been 5 years
yes,
since the last record. What you been up to?
Busy. Still singing.
Mm-hmm. Now, you told us last time you were here that you knew since the age of 6 that you were going to be a singer.
Oh, yeah, I claimed it.
Although your official debut came somewhat later, you know, another 60 years, but you know, that doesn't make you a singer, right? I mean, you were a singer all along.
Exactly.
What were you singing when you were a teenager, say?
Oh, I was singing all kinds of songs, secular songs, and the nightclub for a couple of years. I just kept myself going because I knew one day change was going
to
come. So I just held on to my dreams.
So, you know, one of the funny things about this kind of classic gospel and classic soul sound, it is one sound, you know, and some of it is very secular, some of it is more sacred, but the sound world, it sort of admits both, it accommodates both of those.
Exactly.
So you grew up with both in that?
I did.
Hmm. And how long have you and Cliff been working together?
Oh, my, over 40-some years.
Wow.
We're going to tell it.
Now, there's the new album is out on Daptone Records. They didn't just make the record, though. They came to your house on Jefferson Avenue in Brooklyn and did a little video. You welcome us into your house and show us around a bit. How long have you been on Jefferson Avenue?
Oh, over 50 years.
Wow.
And where I live now, I've been there 35.
Mm-hmm. And are you looking to stay or move?
No, I'm looking to move because my leg don't allow me to stay there too much longer.
Oh, because of stairs and stuff? Yeah, yeah. You must have seen pretty dramatic changes in the neighborhood over 35 years.
Oh, yes, it has.
Like what?
Well, things got higher.
Yes.
Can't hardly stay there. But, you know, it's have changed over. But like now, you know, you have all people from all nationality, which makes it good.
Right.
Yeah, because as the world changed, we have to learn how to change with it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what it's all about.
So this new album called Cold World, is it a cold world out there?
Yes, it is. It's a cold world out there, but I figure I may not be around to see it. But before it's all over, it's going to be a love world.
Well, you're going to make it a little warmer, right?
Yes.
You want to sing the title track for us?
Yes, we do. Thank you.
Naomi Shelton and the Gospel Queens playing for us here in the Soundcheck studio today. The song is called It's a Cold, Cold World.
It's a cold, cold world we're living in.
Yes, it is.
It's a cold, cold world we're living in.
I know it is.
It's a cold, cold world we're living in.
All you got to do today,
trust in Jesus, you'll find a friend.
Tell one more time.
It's a cold, cold world we're living in.
Yes, it is.
It's a cold, cold world
Naomi Shelton and the Gospel Queens here in the Soundcheck studio. The song is called It's a Cold, Cold World. And again, the album called Cold World is out now. It was released last week. Naomi, I mentioned this video that they shot in your house in Brooklyn. I just want to tell people they can find it online at soundcheck.org. In the video, you talk about meeting Gabriel Roth from Daptone Records for the first time. How long ago was that?
Oh, I would say maybe about 13, 14 years ago.
Yeah.
But Gabe was our bass player for about 4 years.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, you guys were, you were doing this for a long time before that first record came out. There's also in the video a moment where you show us your collection of very sparkly hats.
Yes.
One of which is on the cover of the new record, right? Mm-hmm. And you're kind of sparkling here in the studio today.
Yes.
It's very nice. Well, Naomi Shelton and the Gospel Queens will be playing at the Bowery Ballroom here in town on August 28th, later this month, and then next month, September 13th, across the river in New Jersey at the Amwell Valley Music Festival in Hillsboro. They've been playing for us here in the Soundcheck studio today, and Naomi, it's great to see you and the band back in action with the new record. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Got a song you'd like to play us out with?
Yes, I have another song I'd like to play called I Don't Know.
Once again, Naomi Shelton and the Gospel Queens live on Soundcheck.
Thank you.
can I know?
How can I know?
Listen, y'all. How can I ask you where you go? I don't know where you been. I cannot judge the path that you walk, but you, I ain't stepped in. See, I may look to you as a bad man sitting all alone in jail. How can I know you're not a sad man? You walk the rugged trail. How can I know a man before I heard his tale? I don't know. How can I ask you what you're doing? And I don't know what's been done. I cannot truly, truly know all the Father. And I don't truly known the Son. But if you take something before I call you greedy, let me just ask what we're taking from you. You were down and needed. Hey, I know the cover with, had I done my reading. I don't know. How can I know? I just want to ask the question today, y'all.
I wish I knew. How can I know?
But that's all right, I'm not worried, because there's a man that says,
I don't know.
I'd like to know.
How can I know?
But that's all right, listen, y'all. I don't know. How can I know?
How can I know?
Thank you.
Naomi Shelton and the Gospel Queens with their song, I Don't Know. Up next, the film 20,000 Days on Earth depicts 24 hours in the life of the iconic singer and songwriter Nick Cave. The film's a work of fiction, co-written by Cave himself, but since the artist is sufficiently bizarre in real life, it can be hard to tell where the fiction ends and the real life begins. We'll talk with the directors of the film next. This is Soundcheck.
The problem was, she had a little black book, and my name, it was written on every page.
This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. In the background, you're hearing a performance by the band Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds. This is a scene from the new film 20,000 Days on Earth, which follows the 56-year-old Australian singer-songwriter on what seems to be a day in his life. A very busy day as he works in the studio on the album that would become the band's 2013 record, Push the Sky Away. He also digs through artifacts in his personal archive, drives around in his car, conversing with friends like singer Kylie Minogue. But this documentary film doesn't quite behave like a documentary. It's more of a personal manifesto and a very candid look inside Nick Cave's creative process. Joining us here to talk about it are the directors behind 20,000 Days on Earth, Ian Forsyth and Jane Pollard. Guys, welcome to Soundcheck.
Hi.
Hello, thank you.
So how did this film start? This wasn't the initial idea, was it?
No, it started with a really small idea, which was we were in the studio with Nick filming, and nobody had ever really filmed that band that early in their process. And the footage we were getting was just remarkable. It was something so much. It deserved not to just whimper out onto YouTube in some 10-minute making of clip. We knew we had to do something more with it. So we decided we needed a bigger boat, a vessel of some description, and a film, an ambitious film, seemed to be the way to do it. I mean, we started very much with that idea of how do you make a normal, ordinary documentary about an artist as extraordinary as Nick Cave. You have to have something bigger, different, more ambitious.
Well, and you also have to have the trust of that artist. Now, you guys, Ian, have you worked with Nick Cave a lot?
Yeah, we've known each other a few years now, so we've kind of, I think the film could only really be made with that friendship behind us. So we've worked together maybe 7 or 8 years now. We've done various things. We've made music promo videos with Nick, and we produced the soundtrack for The Death of Bunny Munro, his novel, the audiobook, and all sorts of things. And over that time, you know, you grow to know each other pretty well.
So you could, in fact, be a fly on the wall during those early studio sessions, as opposed to, you know, things always change when the observer prints, the observer effect,
yeah,
right?
For sure.
Jane, it seems like one of the great kind of gifts of this film is to watch Nick Cave and the band sort of working out the process, working out the songs. Early on in the movie, we get a chance to hear Nick Cave and the band sort of workshopping the song Higgs Boson Blues, which would come out on the album, Push the Sky Away. And then later in the film, where's this concert shot where we hear the same song live?
That's in a small show in London.
We did
a small show in London, yeah.
So you hear a little bit of the song in progress and then the finished product from the film called 20,000 Days on Earth.
I'll let the damn day break. Rainy days always make me sad. Miley Cyrus floats in a swimming pool in Toluca Lake.
Miley Cyrus floats in a swimming pool in Toluca Lake. You're the best girl I ever had.
Cave recorded live in London, and the song is called Higgs Boson Blues. We heard a little bit of Nick and the band sort of workshopping that in his studio in Brighton. Both of these clips are from the film 20,000 Days on Earth, which 20,000 days is how many years?
It's like 54 and a bit.
So ostensibly, this is how old Nick Cave is on the day in which all this action is taking place.
Yeah, that's the conceit.
That's the conceit.
I mean, the title, that phrase came from Nick directly. It was a phrase that was in his notebook, and we borrowed. Nick writes in longhand and, you know, writes an awful lot of material and then edits a lot to get to the record.
And also types on a typewriter, an old-fashioned typewriter with the black and red ribbon. And
I mean, I think for Nick, it's, you know, the process is really important. And I think once he's gone through a number of revisions in longhand, he likes to go to the typewriter and type up a revised final version of a lyric.
Right. And we see him in the studio, you know, kind of reading off of his typewritten sheets as he's working out the songs. Ian Forsyth, Jane Pollard are with me on Soundcheck, directors of the, let's call it a documentary. What do you guys call it?
We try not to. It's a film.
film called 20,000 Days on Earth, which won awards for Best Directing and Best Editing at this year's Sundance Film Festival. It opens here in New York on September 17th. speaking of, you know, watching the process unfold, there's a really neat moment where Nick Cave talks about, you know, how early on in the process things like counterpoint become important and how that plays out. Listen to this.
Do you want to know how to write a song? Songwriting is about counterpoint. Counterpoint is the key. Putting two disparate images beside each other and seeing which way the sparks fly. Like letting a small child in the same room as, I don't know, a Mongolian psychopath or something. And just sitting back and seeing what happens. Then you send in a clown, say, on a tricycle. And again, you wait and you watch. And if that doesn't do it, you shoot the clown.
Now, this just reminds me that throughout his career, Nick Cave has been dogged by the fact that he has this really dark, dry, deadpan sense of humor, which he has ascribed to being Australian. I think it's just because he's Nick Cave, personally. But what we just heard, that's there are moments of narration, clearly scripted narration by Nick, but then there's a lot of stuff that seems to be unscripted, where it's just kind of unfolding, you know, a psychotherapy session, a trip to his personal archives and stuff. So how much of this was planned and how much of this did you guys just kind of throw in front of him?
Well, the narration, the voiceovers that you hear, they were all written in advance, of course. Nick wrote those. Everything else is, broadly speaking, improvised. There was no dialogue script going into making the film. And one of the big principles we had as filmmakers was that we didn't want to treat Nick like an actor. So we never had a kind of cause to go, can we go back and do that again? Or look, could you just say that line slightly differently or slightly clearer? So consequently, we had to film an awful lot.
A lot of what we see is Nick in his car, you know, and people sort of appear in the car. And the way it's edited, at one moment they're there and the next minute he's in the car alone again. Mm-hmm. And it's like, it's almost like he's hallucinating that these folks are in the car with him.
Yeah.
He's so important in my life. You were like this kind of mist that rolled in. Because I knew about you and had heard about your desire to do this song. And then I saw you perform live with the Bad Seeds and I was like, ugh. You're walking up this ramp to go on stage. It was like a scene from a film. You all just had this kind of swagger and the energy, you know, when you're building up to go on stage. And then the performance was just electrifying and your body language, you were like this, like a tree. That probably doesn't sound...
Like a big tree?
Like, you know, like from a Hitchcock film, a kind of tree in silhouette, like really... in a storm or something. It was amazing.
Because you didn't know much about what I did, right?
No, I had to speed read your biography.
Oh, you read that thing?
Yeah.
That wasn't the truth, so...
now, he did have a kind of a... It was a minor car accident in Brighton a few years ago, but, you know, it turned into like a big media thing because he is Nick Cave and the British media got hold of it. So he took out a speed camera there in Brighton. His twin sons were in the back seat, but everyone was fine.
Oh, yeah.
But, you know, the image of him driving in a car, we heard it in the Higgs Boson Blues that we were listening to a moment ago. And there's a lot of Nick Cave in his car in this film called 20,000 Days on Earth. So, you know, he talks pretty openly about his childhood, growing up, his family, the first time he saw Susie, his wife. We don't hear anything about any of the women pre-Susie. So were there certain things that you guys knew were off-limits going into this?
Not at all, no. I mean, Nick really totally threw himself open to the process. But the thing for us that was really important was that we were making a film about Nick now, right here, right now. So there wasn't a kind of... I mean, if you remember the opening sequence of the film, you see a big, fast montage of a lot of library material, Nick, mm-hmm. over the years. I mean, for us, that was really about kind of clearing the slate, just going, look, that's 19,999 days of Nick's life. That's out of the way in the first minute of the film.
Right.
And now we wake up today and we're talking about Nick now.
At the age of 54 years and some odd days, whatever 20,000 adds up to. Now 56 years old, Nick Cave is the subject of the film 20,000 Days on Earth. With me in the soundcheck studio, the two directors of the film, Ian Forsyth and Jane Pollard. 20,000 Days on Earth opens here in New York on September 17th. Let me ask you about the psychotherapy session, because, you know, this really does go to a lot of the stuff that is in that opening montage. He goes back to, you know, his childhood in Australia and talking about his dad and his dad's death and stuff like that.
Did your father ever come to see you play?
He came a couple of times. Both times I didn't know that he was there. He came to the first New Year's Eve show that I did. It was a show on a street, and I was kind of rolling around drunk and singing. The whole band were off their faces. Mm. And he asked me how it had gone, and I said, oh, it was good. And he went, yeah, I know, I was there. Mm. But then he saw me before he died. It was a paid gig at a club, like a proper band. And he was at that too, and he saw that, and he made this comment, you were like an angel, he said. I can't imagine how he could have seen me in that way, quite frankly.
Seen you as an angel?
Yes, an angel. All things considered.
Is that a real psychotherapist? Is that, you know, how was that scene done?
Yeah, Darian Leader is one of Britain's leading psychoanalysts. He's a brilliant kind of post-Freudian practitioner, and he writes a lot of books as well. He's also a good friend of ours. And we knew that he would be able to... We thought he'd get on with Nick. That was important. And we knew we could trust him. We could trust him to lead a discussion over 2 days that would... that wouldn't kind of let Nick off the hook in the way that I think journalists often do. Mm. You know, that they have prepped kind of... they've already prepped the questions they're going to ask, and they have such short amount of time that it that Nick kind of is able to say a lot of the same things. We wanted something that... just went further, lasted longer, a sort of endurance test. That scene, 2 days, 10 hours of footage, and we shot it 2 months ahead of everything else. So we really used that to identify a lot of the themes that we were then going to kind of play out in the rest of the film.
One of those themes is, you know, his current home, Brighton. He talks early on in the film about how you know, the place just kind of sucks him in, and, you know, He's put down roots there and is very much part of it. And there's a very funny quote towards the end of the film where he talks about the weather in Brighton. Listen to this.
The sky in Brighton is unlike anything I've ever seen. Living by the sea, looking out my windows, I feel like I'm part of the weather itself. Sometimes the sky is so blue and the reflection of the sea so dazzling you can't even look at it. And other times, great black thunderheads roll across the ocean, and you feel like you're inside the storm itself. What I fear most is nature. Now that it's sent its weather to exact revenge, we're all in for it now. Soon the weather is going to put on a real show. Funnily enough, the more I write about the weather, the worse it seems to get. And the more interesting it becomes. And the more it molds itself to the narrative I've set for it. You know, I can control the weather with my moods. I just can't control my moods, is all.
Again, a great line from Nick Cave. I can control the weather with my moods. I just can't control my moods, is all. And the music in the background that was done as the soundtrack for the film is by?
Nick Cave and Warren Ellis.
And Warren Ellis is a longtime multi-instrumentalist, violinist, collaborator who we see a lot of in the course of the film. So one of the main things that I came away from this movie with was the idea of how Nick Cave has moved from being very much a solo artist to a very, very collaborative one. I mean, collaborating with you guys on the film, but... you know, having Kylie Minogue in the back of the car, having Blixa Bargeld appear suddenly in the car from the German band Einstürzende und Neubauten, but another longtime collaborator with Nick. These kind of surprising reminders of just how collaborative his art form has become now.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's one of the incredible things about Nick as an artist, really, is that he's managed to have several of those unique relationships that, you know, you think of the classic kind of rock and roll partnerships and you think of, like, you know, Mick and Keith and all that kind of thing. And they're relationships that either, you know, come and go very quickly and people go their own ways and never quite recapture that kind of magic, or they last a lifetime. And I think for Nick, the idea that he's been able to have that relationship with Blixa, with Mick Harvey, with Roland Howard, now very, very much with Warren Ellis, mm-hmm. it's a pretty unique and remarkable thing.
The creative process very much in play in the film called 20,000 Days on Earth, a collaborative project of Ian Forsyth and Jane Pollard, the two directors who've been here with me in the Soundcheck studio, and featuring the singer-songwriter Nick Cave and various members of his band, past and present. Ian, Jane, thank you both very much for being with us.
Pleasure.
Thank you. Nice to meet you.
I was right, and I was right. The sun was rising from the field.
20,000 Days on Earth opens here in New York on September 17th. Tomorrow on the show, the story of one of pop music's strangest outsiders. Frank Sidebottom was the comic persona of the English musician Chris Seavey, who always portrayed Frank while wearing a big, cartoonish fiberglass head. And we'll hear a live set from Somi. She was born in America to parents from Uganda and Rwanda, and now makes what she calls New African Jazz. We call it really great summer music, and we'll get a live performance from Somi and her band tomorrow. That does it for the show today. I'm John Schaefer. This is Soundcheck.